podcast from AusCert's 2009 conference is brought to you by Microsoft. For full risky business coverage of AusCert, point your browser to risky.biz.
Hello everyone and welcome to Risky Business 2 on risky.biz. The following is David Rice's talk from AusCert's 2009 conference. David is a sensational public speaker. I actually podcasted his keynote from the GovCert conference in the Netherlands that I recorded last year. Now, this talk is similar but sufficiently different to warrant posting here. And for those who haven't heard David speak before, you're in for a real treat. He's a very good speaker. David is best known as the author of Geekonomics, The Real Cost of Insecure Software, and he works as a consultant with the Monterey Group. Enjoy.
So, the need for customer-centric signaling. What in the world does that mean? Well, you live in a very complex world. You live in a 21st century, and are any of you pharmacologists? No, but you can still take drugs quite well, right? Both legal and otherwise. Are you auto safety engineers? No, but you can purchase vehicles. Are you experts in the conversion of kinetic energy into some type of transfer to a transmission in your vehicle? No. These are all things that are very complex devices, and yet all of the complexity is abstracted away from you. And how in the world do you make your buying decisions? Well, oftentimes it's because you're signaled in different ways. And that's what this talk focuses on, but it focuses on it from an aspect of cybersecurity. Now, this was Senator Barack Obama during the elections in the United States, and he said, it's no secret that terrorists could use our computer networks to deal us a crippling blow. Now, given that it's 2008, that's actually a really shocking statement, but it's not only true for the United States, it's true for the European Union, it's true for Australia, in fact, it's true for any nation that relies on software infrastructure. Software infrastructure is literally the foundation of our civilization now. We need it. We can't do without it. So to understand the context of customer-centric signaling, we have to understand the story of a couple of different things. We have to understand the story of broken windows, of carrots, of lemons, and Van Gogh. And yes, it all does hang together. At least that's what I hope. So, understand the story of broken windows. Well, the story of broken windows starts like this. Once upon a time, there was a village, and in that village was a bakery. And in that bakery was a baker who loved to bake bread. Now, one day a young hoodlum comes along and breaks the baker's window. And the once happy baker is now furious. Furious. And of course, as all these stories tend to go, the young hoodlum ends up getting away, as well as his friends. Now, all of this yelling tends to attract a crowd. And when the crowd shows up and they see the broken window, well, gosh darn it, they see the furious baker, they too get very angry. Because that's what happens oftentimes when you see things like this. How could this young hoodlum, what are happening to the youth today? And everyone gets angry, and of course they show their displeasure. And of course even this guy gets in on the act. It's all about don't break windows. Normal people don't break windows. That's not the right thing to do. Now, human in nature is such is that once we've had time to vent our frustrations, we tend to look for a silver lining in this dark cloud. It's in our nature, because at heart we know that for every misfortune, well, there's a bright side. And Monty Python told us that wonderful song, always look on the bright side of life. I don't sing, obviously. I'm a better speaker, man. But that's part of our nature, that if we're overwhelmed with these things in our lives, we tend to look for the brighter side, and that's normal. So that causes the crowd to consider something different. So they consider the fact that because this window is broken, well, the baker now has to pay this man. This man is the glassmaker. And of course, he makes the glass that will fix the broken window. Now, because the baker has to pay the glassmaker now has money to go spend on other merchants. This is a great thing, because now that merchant has more money to go spend on other merchants, and those merchants spend money on other merchants, and those merchants spend on other merchants, and on, and ad infinitum. This is a good thing, right? So the logical conclusion then from this, if the crowd actually drew it, was the fact that the hoodlum, far from being a menace to society, was actually a social benefactor. Wow, that makes sense. Now, it sounds like a good idea, but we know it's not in economics. Why? Well, because the crowd is accurate insofar as that the broken window does result in business for the glassmaker. What the crowd never sees is this man. This man is the tailor, and he makes new suits. Now, this very morning, the baker had every intention of going to buy a new suit, but instead, what did he have to do? Fix a broken window. So the baker now has a fixed window, but no new suit. So the baker then, if you think of him as part of the community has been robbed a suit that otherwise would have appeared but for the broken window. And thus the community in general is just that much poorer. So what happens here is that the real cost of a broken window is certainly the cash that the baker paid. It's that plus the thing he never got. He didn't get this suit because of the broken window. So this is really critical and central to the way we approach this problem. Because the crowd is, they see the baker and the glassmaker in this transaction, but they will never see this man, the tailor, precisely because he will never appear. This is important in economics because the crowd will see the broken window be fixed in a day or two, but they will never see the new suit because the new suit will never appear. The crowd then, their big mistake is the fact that the glassmaker's gain in business is merely the tailor's loss of business. So the broken window is actually a diversion of demand. So no new wealth was created. That's important. No new wealth was created. So this broken window is replaced, and because it was replaced, the suit never appeared. So demand then, demand for new things such as a suit, was transmuted into need or replacement. Now, we know then that the hoodlum, far from being a social benefactor, is actually truly a menace. He really is, because he's taking something greater away from us. So this might sound crazy, but we see stories like this, such as natural disasters. Katrina, which was devastating the United States, over $100 billion in losses. So when we look at Katrina, we understand that it was devastating, but we still see the same mistake made in the press. That is, despite the human tragedy, Hurricane and Katrina could ultimately have a positive impact on the economy. Why? Well, because cars that are damaged need to be replaced with new cars. Homes that are damaged need to be replaced. Windows that are broken need to be fixed. So, but this is replacement fundamentally. It's replacement, it's not demand. And this is critical in economics because people in this case are spending just to stay in place. They're on the rat wheel. They're spending just to stay in place, just to regain status quo. Very good album, by the way. So intuitively, we get this. Because if we phrase it a little bit differently, that if destruction really is good for the economy, then, well, heck, why wait for Mother Nature? Okay? Just do it yourself. Seriously. But I don't know too many people who would go out and willingly destroy their home in order to stimulate the economy. But that's in fact what we see in news stories, or the assumption that, well, because this thing was broken, it was actually good because we had to replace it. That's exactly it. It's replacement. So the moral of the story then is that need doesn't drive economies. Okay? Purchasing power does, and purchasing power is all about demand. Demand, demand, demand. It's the ability to create new things, not replace the stuff that you already had. So the economics of broken windows teaches a couple of things. That the real cost of something is whatever you give up in order to get it. And that damage, no matter what it is always, always a net loss. And then finally, that need is a diversion of demand. And everyone is poor because of it. Now, those are the economic lessons. What about the social lessons? Well, the social lessons are also important because we look at it from the viewpoint of two criminologists, George Kelling and James Wilson. And what they proposed was a theory of broken windows. And the theory of broken windows state that small elements disorder, like a broken window, if left unrepaired, broadcasts a message of disorder into the environment, which in turn invites more elements of disorder. And those elements of disorder, if left unrepaired, invite more elements of disorder. And if those aren't addressed, it invites more serious forms of disorder, even crime. So that's in theory. What about in practice? What about when we bring this thing to the mat, what does it look like? Well, we can look to New York City in the 1980s. And as we know, the subway system in the 1980s was absolutely appalling. It was rife with prostitution, with robbery, with rape, with murder. It was a horrible environment. And estimates said that it was about cost New York City about $120 million per year, despite all the intangible costs of lost public trust, etc. So one gentleman by the name of David Gunn, who was chief of New York City Transit from 1984 to 1990, and William Bratton, who was chief of New York City Transit Police from 1999 to 1992, were disciples of the broken windows theory. And what they did then was apply this not to fight robbery and murderers. They used it to go after fare beaters and subway graffiti. Now, this confused a lot of New Yorkers because, my gosh, these were small things. Why don't you go after the serious criminals? Well, both Mr. Bratton and Mr. Gunn knew that fare beating and graffiti were the broken windows of the New York subway system. It transmitted a message of disorder into the environment, and people responded to that message. Mr. Bratton said it best. He said, robbery, fare beating, disorder, you deal with one, you deal with them all. You deal with one, you deal with them all. So what Mr. Bratton did was then start a pilot program in Grand Central Station with the sole focus of reducing fare beating. And the results were surprising, because what they noticed was a 42% decrease in violent crime for Grand Central Station for the pilot period. That was amazing. Now, this is only just the pilot program. Now, Mr. Gunn, then, what he did was put in place, instituted a clean car program. And what this was a zero-tolerance policy. And what it said, that no car was allowed back into service until it was clean and repaired. Now, to understand the sheer magnitude of this feat, of the hurdle set before them, New York City had over 5,000 vehicles in use during peak hours. This is a significant, almost religious endeavor to keep these things clean and repaired. The goal here was to take away the canvas from graffiti artists by constantly painting over their artwork. We were taking away their canvas. But what was more important here, and the second goal, was that the broadcast message of disorder was replaced with a message of love and peace. Seriously. It was that somebody cared about the environment. Somebody cared enough about the New York City subway system and New York City in general that that sent a different message. Now, what happened as a result of Mr. Gunn and Mr. Bratton's exhaustive labors, because that's in fact what it was a religious endeavor, was startling. It was over a 75% reduction in violent crime in New York City. Now, if you go to New York City, you will still see New York City transit trains relatively free of graffiti and vandalism. I was surprised because I was just there for a while over the summer, and it is remarkably still clean. Not perfect, but remarkable compared to the 1980s, which I went with my parents. Now, fare beating, as of 2008, will cost you $100. That might seem like it's just a nuisance to you, but this is a significant signal that's sent out into the market. Now, there's endless debate about the theory of broken windows, but we know from empirical studies done by Professor Wesley Scogin and all of his empirical work that he did for similar programs in Houston, Chicago, Newark, and Atlanta, that all of these programs had similar results. And in fact, some cases, law enforcement was not even necessary. People reclaimed their neighborhoods simply by cleaning them, simply by fixing broken windows. So what are the social lessons? Small elements of disorder, if left unrepaired, invite more disorder. Okay? Environment strongly influences behavior. Human character is far less intrinsic than we'd like to think. Now, Philip Zimbardo, in his book, The Lucifer Effect, also documents this extensively, and it shows that environment largely dictates human behavior. All you have to do is look at a mob to understand very good people acting very poorly. And they're all churchgoers, too, right? So, the final thing is that strong law enforcement is helpful. It's helpful, but not necessary. We're not talking about a draconian state here of police that gets you for every infraction. We're talking about a message of disorder. Now, what in the world does this have to do with hackers, software, and customer-centric signaling? As it turns out, everything. Because software defects are the broken windows of cyberspace. They broadcast a message out into the environment that in turn invite more disorder, because those bugs incite hackers to say, well, if they didn't get this right, what else did they not get right? And so this bug transmutes into a vulnerability, potentially. And of course, that communicates a message of disorder out in the environment, so you get more elements of disorder, like website defacements. And that, of course, communicates a message of disorder out in the environment, which invites more serious forms of disorder, like data intrusions, and of course, more serious forms of disorder, including cybercrime. So, remember back in the good old late 1990s, when website defacements were all the rage, that we were like, how many websites got defaced today? It was the graffiti of the age. It was the graffiti of the age, and it broadcast a message of disorder out in the environment, and hackers heard it and came running. Running into the environment so that we saw an explosion of cybercrime, over a 1,500% increase in new threats from 2002 to 2007, and 185% increase in new threats from the second half of 2006 to the first half of 2007 alone. A literal explosion of cybercrime. Now, there are some out there that tend to blame users for this because, gosh darn it, you stop clicking on those hyperlinks in email. But that's what they do, right? But oftentimes when we start looking at the data, we see that even with Trojan downloaders, it's often a website that itself got exploited because of vulnerabilities in the website, which in turn turns around and exploits vulnerabilities in the browser or in QuickTime or in Flash. So humans may be a vector, but the vulnerabilities still communicate the message. That's what they're still trying to get to. So the irony in all of this, though, is that hackers, these hoodlums, they're not the ones breaking the windows. Hackers don't break windows. They merely go out and discover the defects that software manufacturers fail to detect themselves before shipping the product. This is critical to understanding how broken windows affects cybersecurity. Hackers don't break windows. They don't throw rocks. They merely go out and discover the defects that software manufacturers fail to detect themselves before shipping the product. The reality is atrocious. This is from a critical infrastructure report back in 2004. Software products have among the highest number of defects of any products sold today. The highest number of defects of any products sold today. When you're building infrastructure, particularly software infrastructure, there's no such thing as a small mistake. Here's an Autodesk ad that says, in civil engineering, there's no such thing as a little mistake. You're off by an inch on a bridge, a bad thing. But when we look into our software infrastructure, we see all these little defects all over the place. When we look at the statistics, it's horrible. Because year on year, we see more and more vulnerabilities being discovered. When we look at our web applications, we see an explosion in the number of latent defects discovered once those products have gone out to market or released out onto the internet. When we look at client-side vulnerabilities, or everyone take a moment, beloved virtualization. We look at virtualization, we say, we got to get this stuff everywhere we possibly can. And yet we see the same trend. The product was put out there, and the latent defects only become apparent after the product has shipped. The fact of the matter is that we have no idea how many broken windows come with our products. We have no idea, and largely software manufacturers don't always either. They're surprised sometimes just as much as we are. So hackers, then, aren't breaking windows. The sad fact is these products are broken on acquisition. When we get them, they're broken. So while the analogy of broken windows might be helpful, it's not complete. Because when we look at the trend, when we look at those huge numbers that keep expanding, it's more similar to pollution. And what we see is software manufacturers practicing unrestrained vulnerability dumping on a downstream market participants. And yet we insist that those downstream market participants patch, filter, and protect their systems while doing little to restrain or stem the source of disorder, the source of pollution, and thus the source of disorder. So, it's gotten so bad that some people don't think the internet is safe to use by normal people. Here's Alex Stamos in a Web 2.0 conference. He says, the internet can't be used by normal people, period. Okay? After decades of computer security work, things are worse than they were. Finding bugs and publicizing them is not making people any safer. Worse, because of this epidemic of broken windows, consumers need to spend on patching, filtering, and protecting their systems, and because of this expenditure, this man will never come into the picture. Now, this man is the tailor, and he makes new suits. Now, because of these new suits, because if we think of these consumers as part of a village, the village has been denied a new suit that otherwise would have appeared but for these broken windows. And then, of course, everyone is poor because of it. So, what's the social impact of broken windows and software? Well, software defects communicate a message of disorder into cyberspace, and it says, come and get us. We're purchasing into this disorder. Second part, a continuous stream of broken windows supplied by software manufacturers signals to hackers that no one's in control. Software manufacturers don't know what they're doing, and the defenders certainly don't. That's the message that's being communicated. It's a signal that we're not stemming the tide of the source of disorder, and the source of disorder keeps supplying new disorder out to the environment. Finally, law enforcement actually ends up reacting to the crime, but not to the source of disorder, which means law enforcement gets overtasked rapidly. What's the economic impact? Devastating. Because for every dollar we spend on security products, it's a dollar we can't spend someplace else. That means buyers have patched and protected software and no new suits, no new DVDs, no new cars. Demand is being transmuted into a need that we purchased into. And everyone is poorer because of it. In fact, the more we spend on cybersecurity to fend ourselves against from insecure software, the more we impoverish ourselves. So let's be clear here. Insecure software promotes disorder, invites cybercrime, and destroys wealth, period. Okay, well, how the heck do we change that? Well, to understand how we change, we need to understand the story of carrots. And of course, the story of carrots is all about the story of incentives. Because incentives formulate a system under which people behave. So incentives are good because it's why we exercise for health. It's why we work for wealth. It's why we love for affection. Economists refer to this as self-interest. And self-interest is important because when economists think about self-interest, they think about utility. Utility is like happiness, only more general. That is, they don't really care where you get utility from, only that you do, because utility is really based on a fundamental principle. And that is, you as a normal, rational human being, even an irrational human being, do things because you want to make yourself better off. You're sitting here now because you think you're better off for the sitting. You're in the security profession because you think you're better off for the profession. You think you're playing soccer because you're better off for the playing. You do things to make your life better. Even more importantly, though, is the corollary. You will not intentionally do things that make yourself worse off. And this is almost more important when we start to talk about changing an incentives program. So the nice thing about recognizing self-interest and incentives is that it's less about blame and more about solutions. It's less about blame and more about solutions. So what this isn't about, it's not about perfect software. It's certainly not about perfect software. And it's not about blaming software developers. These are good people in good companies trying to do good things. So they're not the bad guys. The buyers of software aren't the bad guys, and yet they're locked in this death spiral, which we'll get to shortly. What this is really about is crash-worthy, low-emission software where the product has been crash-tested sufficiently so that users don't have to be. The downstream market participants don't have to so devoutly protect themselves from upstream pollution. That's what this is about. So when we look at incentives, we have to look at both positive and negative effects. And we only have time to really look at one negative effect. But this is critical to the story. Now, when we start talking about perverse incentives, it's really about the law of unintended consequences. And the law of unintended consequences where you meant to do well, but it just had rather a negative effect. So if you're looking to save the giraffes, for heaven's sakes, don't take a helicopter in. Drive. Okay? But that's really what it comes down to, is that you meant to do well, but what happens is something else happens that you didn't anticipate. So to understand the story of unintended consequences, then, you have to understand the story of lemons. And the story of lemons starts with a man named, George Akerlof. So George Akerlof is a Nobel laureate, and what he noted was a market for lemons in the used car market. Okay? So what he noticed was when large information asymmetries existed between buyers and sellers, that is, sellers knew more than buyers, in that case, what happened was price became the distinguishing element in purchasing decisions. So if you look at the right-hand side of your slide, you'll see a great car, and that great car is about $3,000. And on the left-hand side of the slide, you'll see a bad car, and that bad car is about $100 or so. Now, you as a buyer sit there and think, well, I really don't know about the quality of this used car compared to that used car. $3,000 sounds like an awful lot to pay for a car I don't know the quality of, so I'm going to give myself pretty good odds. I'm going to go for the difference, $1,500, because then I have a 50-50 chance of getting a great car and a 50-50 chance of getting a bad car. Either I get a great deal for half the price, or if it's a bad deal, I'm not spending $3,000. I'm losing only half the money I intended to spend. Now, as a seller, you can't possibly get a fair market price for your vehicle. You can't. Because no one's going to offer it to you. So what happens is you withdraw your product from the market. That's entirely rational because you're trying to make yourself better off. You're not about to sell your car under market value. But what happens then here is that now sellers have made themselves worse off because now they have a choice between an average car and a bad car. And what do? They split the difference. They say, well, this car is $1,500. This one's $100. Well, I'm going to offer $750. And what happens? If you're the seller, you leave the market because you can't possibly get a fair market price for your vehicle. Now, as a seller, what do you have a choice between? A less than average car and a bad car. You've just made yourself worse off, even though you didn't mean to. Now, what happens here is a death spiral, that high-quality cars are driven from the market and low-quality cars tend to dominate. Everyone's acting rationally here. You as a buyer are trying to get a good deal. You as a seller are trying to get a fair price. And, of course, your behavior leads to a death spiral. Now, how does this apply to software, though? Well, when you look at software, when you see large information asymmetries in the software market, what you see is features becoming the distinguishing element in purchasing decisions. Why? Why not price? Because you can get your software for free if you really want to, right? So when we look at this, we see on the right-hand side, great, secure software, and on the left-hand side, bad, horrible software. Now, it's really hard to make great software, right? So you reduce your feature count because it's really hard to write great software with lots of features. So what you do is create a decent set of features that you think are good, and someone else creates a lot more. Now, the problem here is that you can't compete because buyers are looking at what? Feature count. But they're not looking for the super ultimate premium version of the software. They just want the home version, right? So they go for the home version with 500 features instead of 1,000 features. I don't need all those features. I'm going to go with something more reasonable. But what happens is that even in that rational choice, the makers of more secure software can't compete with feature count, and what they do is end up leaving the market. Or in reality, they go into a niche market, don't they? And they sell to financial services companies or governments. And you say, you want secure software? Pay me. But what happens here is that less rich clients can't get secure software. Now what you have as a seller or as a buyer choice between average software and bad software. And of course what happens, the average guys can't compete with the bad guys. And so now you have a choice between less than average software and bad software. The ultrasumer premium version of whatever it is because it has so many darn features. What happens here though is the same thing, a death spiral where high quality secure software is driven from the market and lower quality insecure software tends to dominate. Lower quality but feature rich. Now, what's crazy here is that less scrupulous parties enter the market. Guys who just write their own Trojan codex. Why? Because users don't know the difference between great software and bad software, so they'll load any software, whether it's Trojaned or not. This allows criminals the behaviors that we tell them are horrible. And of course, everyone's acting rationally here. Software manufacturers have every right to put as many features in their product. You have every right to demand as many features as you want, but you're stuck in a death spiral. So, in the used car market, price was the discount we offered for an unknown level of quality in our vehicles. And in the software market, features are the discount we offer for an unknown number of defects, an unknown number of broken windows. Features are the discount we give for bad software. And why do you think we have so many features? So what Akerlof really noted here was market failure. That is, where incentives in the marketplace are in such a state that you simply can't self-correct. So when we look at software manufacturers, they're not going to forego market share to create more secure software. They're not going to, nor should they. Sacrilege. And buyers aren't going to forego demand for features. Why? They shouldn't. I have every right to look for granite countertops in my home or 22-inch rims on my car. Features are what we like. There's nothing wrong with wanting them, but you can see how the effect is less. And of course, hackers are not going to forgo hacking tens of millions of vulnerable systems. They're just not going to stop. You supply them with vulnerabilities, they will mine those vulnerabilities. So we need some new incentives. What are they? Well, when you look at incentives, we know that when people engage in activities that impose a high social cost, that is, there's a large negative externality, it makes people worse off for their individual behaviors, it usually means the private cost is too low. So how do we correct this? Well, we need to raise the private cost of a particular activity. So in economics, we call this internalizing an externality. So if the private cost of listening to loud music is too low, but the social cost is very high, we raise the private cost by fining those people who listen to loud music. Okay? Driving a car. The private cost of driving a car may be too low, while the social cost is high in terms of congestion and pollution. So what do? We raise the private cost. And in some countries, they've implemented road pricing schemes, which says if you're on the road during certain hours, you're going to pay a certain amount of money. It's raising the private cost. Industrial pollution, industrial manufacturing, the private cost of industrial manufacturing may be too low, and the social cost may be quite high. So what we do is raise the private cost by taxing pollution, sulfur dioxide emission taxes, carbon emission taxes. We also raise the private cost by making you feel bad. Because gosh darn it, your carbon footprint is too big, and when you fly to conferences like in Australia, you should feel bad about it. But that's what we're trying to do, right? Raise the private cost through social pressure to make you feel bad about it. But what's the private cost of insecure software, of unrestrained vulnerability dumping on a downstream market participants? Well, some might argue that the private cost is near zero because they don't pay for your security staff. Software manufacturers don't pay for your antivirus. They don't pay for your IDS or your data protection software or patching processes. They don't pay any of those expenses, which you have to do on a regular, ongoing basis and pay the compliance fines if you don't. So when you look at the social cost of insecure software, it's quite high, and in some cases, some might argue that it's devastating. Here is simply a Wall Street Journal article, hackers have penetrated a U.S. electrical network, which, by the way, could happen to any of us. So when we look at incentives, we have to understand at least two aspects. Two aspects that I want to focus on here. Two aspects is it should be more expensive to make insecure software than it is to make more secure software. And finally, buyers should have clear, observable, reliable signals to solve this information asymmetry problem that we noted in the used car market and that we see in the software market. Now, to give us context, it took us 80 years to get to the modern safe car that we appreciate today. 80 years of legal action, regulatory action, legislative acts. It was a long, long process. And you know what the arguments were at the very beginning of all this? You can't do it. It's impossible to regulate autos because they're just so darn dynamic and innovative. Here's a quote from The Struggle for Auto Safety. It says, by most early accounts, the automobile was indeed a technological marvel, one whose performance and affordability were improving dramatically from year to year. A federal attempt to standardize a rapidly developing and rapidly improving technology, whose innovations were enthusiastically received by the populace, by the way, looked like an errand for the politically foolish. In fact, GM said, you can't measure auto safety. It's impossible. And of course, these are many of the same arguments we see today in the software market. Oh, we're far too innovative to be regulated. Oh, no, it's too dynamic to be regulated. Oh, no, you can't measure software security. Don't even try. Same arguments, different time period. And some of it may be true. Maybe it is too hard. Maybe it's not. But we're not having the discussion, and that's a crime. So when we look at auto safety was really an intangible in the marketplace. Because how do you look at a product and say, oh yeah, it's safe? And that's the problem here, because consumers couldn't tell the difference between a safe car, in this case this is a 1972 Honda, and an unsafe car, which is a Pinto. And if you're familiar with the Pinto, if you crash into the back of it, the darn thing blew up. Now how are you supposed to know that when you're looking at the vehicle? You can't, because auto safety is an intangible in the marketplace. This way, when you can't see it, it's impossible to price your risk. And that's the exact problem. People could not price their risk. They didn't know if they got in that car, they had a 50% greater chance of dying than if they got into another one. They didn't know how to price that risk. So what we saw was an enormous information asymmetry between buyers and sellers. And in fact, auto manufacturers really didn't know about the safety of their vehicles either, just like software manufacturers don't know about the security of their own software. They simply don't, until it's made visible for both buyers and sellers. But you still have a large information asymmetry problem because buyers literally have less information to go on because they're not the experts. They're not the software developers. They're not the auto manufacturers. So this signaling is important, and in order to solve that, NHTSA was created by the 1966 Motor Vehicle Safety Act. And what it instituted was a 5-star rating on vehicles. Now, what this really, and this was also adopted by NCAP and also by the Australian New Car Program, by ANCAP. Now, we decorate these vehicles to get the intangible visible to the end user. Now, this is also a critical point that we'll come back to. But what this thing really is a cleverly designed taxation scheme. A very broad, very generic taxation scheme, which says that if you're a bad software manufacturer, if you're a bad auto manufacturer, that is, you're creating unsafe cars, you will get penalized for making a less safe car in the marketplace. So that consumers now will then enforce this decision in their transaction at the actual dealership. And those cars that aren't less or aren't more safe will get pushed out of the market. Literally, you're taxed out of existence by the actions of the consumer. This makes making a 2-star rated car significantly more expensive than a 5-star rated car. Why? Because if you insist on making a 2-star rated car, you will forego all the revenues you could have had if you made a 5-star rated car. This makes making an unsafe car far more expensive than making a safe car, because you just got taxed out of existence if you didn't behave properly. So when we signal, it also allows manufacturers to coordinate on competition. What they do is look for the most effective safety that they can get at the most reasonable price, and they innovate like you've never seen them innovate before when it's made visible. The result, 90% of cars in the U.S. are either 4- or 5-star rated. And in Australia, you have a 30% less risk of death or serious injury in a 2005 car compared to a 1990 car. When we look at the differential between a 2005 car and a 1960 car, you have almost 2 orders of magnitude less risk. You are never more safe than in a 2005 car. And of course, 2007 is even better. In fact, this program has been so effective, it's increasing its capacities. Now, here's the most significant part that you need to worry about here, or be recognized. That whether you're rich or whether you're poor, you still get safety. In fact, you have less of a chance, you have more of a chance of buying a 3-star rated car in the luxury market than you do in the underclass market. Why? Well, because there's more distraction at the luxury level. Okay? But what's important here is that whether you're rich or poor, you still get safety. There's an even distribution of safety across the spectrum of buyers. In software land, the only way you're going to get secure software is if you're rich. Insecure software discriminates against the non-rich, because only the rich can afford high quality, high secure software, because you're paying millions for it. It's a discriminatory model. We want to see something more evenly distributed, where the small business, the individual user, or the mega enterprise get software security, not just the big players. So the 5-star rating system in the auto manufacturer land or automobile industry has been so effective that NHTSA is considering adding a 6th star to more strongly differentiate it between safer cars. So the race to the top has begun in the auto market. In the software market, it's all about a race to the bottom. How many feature sets can you get out there? How much market domination can you achieve in the shortest amount of time? And, well, you know, screw defects. We'll just put them out in the marketplace and let you deal with them. So intangibles are not part of the beauty contest until they're made visible. They're not part of the beauty contest until they're made visible. This is true for auto safety. It's true for energy efficiency. It's true for fuel efficiency in your vehicles. It's true for organics. It's true for nutrition. And it should be true for software. David Platt's book is wonderful. Why Software Sucks. We know software sucks. We just don't know how much. We have no idea how many broken windows comes in our software. We know it. We just don't have a measure of it. So labels are also important, because what they do is democratize an intangible so that everyone can see this stuff. Everyone can see this stuff, not just the experts. Even more importantly is what this does is coordinate consumers on a massive scale that you don't even see in industry sectors. This allows every buyer, whether you're financial, whether you're nonprofit, whether you're government, whether you're private, whatever it is, it allows you to coordinate in ways you couldn't coordinate even within industry sectors. This is important. Now, why in the world do we focus on consumers? Very important. Why? Because private consumption represents 70% of U.S. GDP, 60% of EU GDP, and around 50% of Australian GDP. The consumer is very powerful. In contrast, U.S. government spending is only 21% of GDP in the United States. It's actually 19.9% last year. This is down from 25 to 30% in the 1960s. U.S. government really doesn't spend that much in the marketplace, even though they're considered a big player. Australian government spends about 43% of total GDP. Now, this is important because Australia spends twice as much in terms of percentage than the U.S. does, and Australia still uses the ANCAP program in order to signal to consumers. This is important. Why? Because government spending wasn't enough to positively influence safety in the automobile market, and it's not going to be enough to influence security in the software market. Right now in the United States, we have this big push to try to get federal government to influence the software market, and it's a cul-de-sac. It is a cul-de-sac because it hasn't worked in auto safety, it hasn't worked for fuel efficiency, it hasn't worked for toxicology and pharmacological areas, it hasn't worked for fuel efficiency, energy. If take your field, government spending has not influenced the market significantly enough to see the changes we need on a broad enough scale, especially when you start talking about software as a national security issue. Government simply cannot spend enough to influence the market. So how in the world do we make this digital stuff, which is intangible, how do we make it tangible? Well, there are some leading the way. There's two companies, Veracode and Fortify. Veracode has a working software assurance model or software assurance labeling regime already in place. It's a deductive model. It's not perfect, but it shows it can be done. Fortify also has a beta program. I'm not privy to the details yet, but I'm sitting down with their chief scientist in order to understand it more. Now, this is all good, but it's very embryonic, and what it requires is individuals to negotiate contracts separately with their software vendors. Highly inefficient, and you have to have the desire and willpower in order to do it. You have to care about software security to get it, and you will pay not only in terms of delivery price, but all of the effort of negotiating the contracts as well. A high barrier to entry, and you have to care about it and have deep pockets to do it. Now, what we'd like to see is something more generic. California emission standards are some of the most strict in the world. It's the seventh largest GDP in the world, even though, of course, my home state's going bankrupt. It's still very powerful in terms of consumer power. And New York State has done the same thing. What it's saying is the states aren't saying, I'm going to use my budget to, you know, create this change in the marketplace. I'm saying I'm going to use my private consumption, my consumers, to influence the market because that's how powerful the consumer is if they're given the ability to coordinate. Now, Australia has on par almost the same amount of purchasing power despite a smaller population in the United States. Australian consumers are very powerful in terms of global standards for consumerism. They have a tremendous amount of influence. So too in America, so too in Sweden, so too in Japan. What we'd like to see is more generic approach to cybersecurity rather than prescriptive compliance mandates. So this all comes back to our broken window, this simple, tiny, broken window. Such a simple lesson from such a simple, almost apparently innocuous thing. But we've seen that broken windows communicate a message of disorder out into cyberspace. It communicates a message that invites more disorder, website defacements, data intrusions, and of course, more serious forms of cybercrime. We've seen incentives. We've seen when incentives go wrong. When incentives go wrong, we get all sorts of negative effects. We've also seen information asymmetry, and that's really key here, because when you can't see the intangible, you can't price the intangible. And if you can't price it, there is no market competition for it, period. So we can choose to go into this cyber battle, like World War I generals insisting on more of the same, on yet ever more security contraptions, all matching some type of bizarre threat. I have my poison-spitting octopus on the right, I've got my scimitar on the left. All of these things we put into the environment, and we just increase the entropy of our overall system, making it more chaotic. And of course, all of these things have more configuration options than we can shake a stick at, right? Now, of course, we don't always get those configuration options right, so then, of course, we have to go to compliance, which is really about trying to coordinate actions among disparate animals and trying to get them to go all in a separate direction. Or what we can actually do is focus on a few thousand software executives, many of whom we know by name, and restrict the flow of vulnerabilities, remove the source of disorder, and bring order back to our networks. We need to make software security visible. We need to make it part of the beauty contest, signal the buyer, overcome the information asymmetry problem, and let the market compete more efficiently, because if you can't price it, there's no reason to make it if I'm a software manufacturer. Now, there are many manufacturers out there that are trying to do better. Microsoft among them. They have a great program. But the incentives in the market are such that no one can really self-correct to the degree that we need them to. Which brings us finally to our last story. And it's a very short story because we're out of time. And this story is about Van Gogh. And he made a recognition, an observation in his life. And what he said was that don't forget that little emotions are the great captains of our life. And if we put this into the context of what Senator Barack Obama said during the election, he said that, of course, it's no secret that terrorists could cripple us. So if we take these two things and merge them together and understand and look at it from a different set of eyes, we see that these little, tiny software defects, these little, tiny broken windows on which our entire nations are built upon, are now the great captains of our nation. These little, tiny defects are now the great captains of our nation. Thank you. Thank you.